So we were talking about a little bit the again the first session we spoke a little bit about Asar Sadibros, and then we speak about Nasav and Ishma last time. I used that both of them trying to introduce the question of how we I guess relate to you know issues that I guess challenge the not necessarily the supremacy of Talmud Torah, that certainly, but even the, let's say, the, you know, the self, thank you, the self-sufficiency of Talmud Torah. Anything that, you know, implies that Torah requires, let's say, supplementary or complementary augmenting and, you know, that kind of challenges in some way, this different phraseology, the idea of Torah Hashem Tamima, or the idea of hafochba, the kulaba, the idea that Torah stands on its own and is self-sufficient. And historically, of course, this figures into, this is a highly sensitive topic, since, you know, our relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam and therefore the meaning of our lives, you know, nothing less than that is all bound up with the gift of Maimed Har Sinai and its content, the Talmud Torah. So anything that implies that that is somehow deficient or not self-sufficient even is something which, you know, is a highly sensitive topic. I'm just trying to put it in a framework, and which is obviously going to attract opinions, interpretations, etc. So the phenomenology of this is it puts a lot of pressure on, you know, statements in Torah Shebichtav and categories in you know, in halacha or in, you know, the application of Torah life, you know, historically, that, you know, whether directly or even obliquely, you know, entail this kind of implications. So I think I mentioned the other day, you know, things like, you know, Lidrosh Eso Elokim, whether that's, you know, halachic or primarily halachic or something else, Tefillah or some other aspect of developing a kesher with the Ribbono Shel Olam, Dveikus with the Ribbono Shel Olam, the idea of Lo Torah El Tzaref Es Abrios, right, a phrase which is very, just 1 second, so make sure there's nothing, no problems here, okay. A phrase which is very loaded and, you know, which is very ambiguous, Litzari Fisabrios, referring to, you know, shaping or molding, you know, the value, I guess, of a person comes from the Torah. That's the one understanding of it, or more, you know, of an arbitrary, like, you know, it's a test of commitment or of discipline. You know, it's like a fire, you know, a battle by fire, you know, but where it's more, as I say, about testing the metal, you know, of one's, the intensity or the absoluteness of one's commitment. These kind of phrases, whether they be, again, in Mikra, Anasa Vinishma, as we talked about last week, you know, what Yiras Elokim means, which we'll get to in just a minute because that's a big issue in the Muslim movement, you know, part of this discussion. Tamei HaMitzvos is a great example of this. The idea that there can be Tamei HaMitzvos is itself one issue. Certainly plenty of support for that in Chazal and in the enterprises of the Rishonim. Even then, it isn't something that is completely obvious from a, again, phenomenological point of view. The idea that that you should be seeking, you know, rational explanations as opposed to simply, you know, diving in and implementing as a devotion. We talked about this a little bit last week when I talked about the charm, you know, in some religions of just a nasa, you know, without a nasa v'nishma, you know, perspective. Somehow that's, you know, perceived in some religions as a higher level, right? Even whether it embraces irrationality or paradox in a Kierkegaardian way, or just, you know, is neutral about rationality or sets rationality apart. The idea of, you know, being, you know, leaping into faith. So tameh mitzvos, as an enterprise, you know, certainly is open to question when it comes to that. And Rabbi Yehuda Levi, in the Kuzari, you know, talks about that. And there are numerous other makoros. You know, the category of chukim in particular becomes a focal point for that. Chukim chakti lecha, right? Ve'en lecha rishus laharher acharai. Although, again, as we know, many of the mefarshim, many of the rishonim, explained that doesn't mean, even in chukim, that you're not supposed to. It just means that there's an inner logic, and that you have, number one, you have to follow your commitment to something which isn't contingent upon your understanding. But in addition to that, you know, for the Rambam and for the Ramban and for the mainstream of Rishonim, you can't be maharachro, I mean, the sense that you can't second guess it. That's different than not trying to understand it. And the best approach is just to use the phraseology of the Rav Zatzal, but I think it's the implicit classical approach. He just formulated it as a difference between asking questions of why and questions of how or what, meaning you pursue Tamiya Mitzvos as a kiyum in Talmud Torah and as a kiyum in your Shmiras HaMitzvos as well. It's a deeper way, a deeper understanding, and a deeper way of performing and of being completely committed to the system. But certainly, the very enterprise of Tamiya Mitzvos and the distinction of, especially the category of Chukim, is something which, you know, is part of this larger story of, again, the Torah as the Torah and Halacha as like a test, as a discipline, you know, as a matter of like a crucible, but basically a faith, or as having content and as being the source of, you know, a very rich spiritual, emotional, religious life. And that's certainly the predominant view of the Rishonim, of the Mefarshim. But of course, the what the, you know, direction Tamei Mitzvot takes is particularly connected, you know, to this question. So it's, you know, more than ironic, although totally predictable, that the critique, you know, of one group of Tamei Mitzvot's people to, you know, the efforts of their predecessors, you know, is typically to accuse or to explain, you know, the new enterprise as being superior to the old enterprise, or to accuse the old enterprise, you know, of having, you know, glorified or brought in external, you know, ideas into the process. In other words, the enterprise of Tamei Mitzvos is fine and good, and especially as a kiyum, you know, from within. But that's only if that's really what it is. If you're looking, to the external, you know, world for your Tamei Mitzvos, then that kind of, you know, corrupts it. And that's why we, whoever the we is, you know, about to embark on the more authentic, you know, Tamei Mitzvos. So this was, very much an accusation that was leveled against the philosophical or purely rationalistic Tamei Mitzvos, especially the Rambam's more nevuchim, you know, types of historical or relativist types of Tamei Mitzvos, that, you know, that it was too informed by, outside sources, and that it wasn't really a good expression, you know, of Dvar Hashem or Shemos Hashem in that sense. Again, the Rav, as we've noted in the past, pointed out in Halach Mind the difference between the Rambam's Tamei Mitzvos and Mor Nevuchim, you know, which is written for a different audience, and those in Yad HaChazaka, and especially, you know, the pieces in the end of the different sections. I brought it with me to tape to quote, but then I left it in my office. But, you know, the Rambam in the end of Hilchos Me'ilah in particular, talks about the primacy of Chukim. The Rambam, the great, you know, rationalist, no one could deny that the Rambam was a great rationalist, but, you know, he talks about not only the obligation to implement chukim, but to understand them. And he talks about shmiras achukim and zehirus about chukim, and rejecting any notion, you know, of being irreverent, you know, just because you understand them less. What he doesn't add, but which would fit in perfectly, is the idea that chukim, in as a, you know, are the ultimate expression, not just of, you know, a leap of faith, they are, but a different kind of leap, a surrender, you know, to a different kind of inner logic. Meaning, chukim really are an inner logic, and therefore, they're. Rambam speaks in the end of Hilchos Me'ilah about how they're prior even to Mishpatim, and that would be a very excellent explanation of that. But the point is that the Rambam was criticized, and fairly, and so were others, that some of his Talmid Mitzvot seem to be external and from the outside, either negative or relativist, historical or external. And then the Baalei Kabbalah, just one more second, I'll take the question, their program was much more internal, obviously, because the theosophic system of the Spheros and the Kabbalah, right, doesn't come from Greece or Rome. Or talked last week about how proponents of Jewish rationalism often felt the need, right, to make the claim, that the real source of philosophy, was Jewish and internal. Rambam never felt really the need to make that claim, but others did. That's an interesting phenomenon. But Kabbalah, of course, is a highly, internal. Professor Tversky, Zichron Livracha, in his works on Provence, really developed this idea in a very impressive way, that one of the advantages and one of the attractions of Kabbalah as a philosophic, companion, let's say, to Halacha, was precisely that it didn't have to contend with this problem of, how do you explain why something external to Torah, something that is accessible, let's say, to other people and to other religions, to other ideologies, how could that be the companion? Again, there are answers to that question, but it's a question, whereas the attraction of Kabbalah was that it was also part of a Mesorah, and a Mesorah which is built on and developed through, especially as it moved forward in the medieval examples of it, through Halakha and through Parshanut, much the same way as we'll discuss in a minute, that Chassidus, many centuries later, later developed after the initial problematic parts of it. Yeah, Aaron, you had a question before.
What does Rabbi Mimon mean when he says inner logic?
What I mean is that, and I'll talk more about this when we talk about Brisk, but what I mean is that not a logic that is borrowed from the outside and that is accessible, to all people, but one which, is based on an internal understanding and also the interrelationships between, aspects of Yahadus itself, or especially in Halacha. In other words, just as an example, let's say Kachim and Taharos, are examples of something that have an inner logic. I mean, if you know the closed system of Taharos and Kachim, right, so they work according to principles, and they are very cohesive system. But, nobody who is not, initiated into that world, it's a self-contained world, right? It's not something that, Aristotle could have come up with, right? Or Plato. So that's what I mean by inner logic. A logic which comes from reconstructing things that you receive through a Mesorah and that have a relationship to each other and therefore have a powerful message once you accept the totality of the system as an insider from the outside. And that's what I mean by an inner logic, basically. And chukim, which are difficult to understand. So again, one could have said that chukim are just difficult to understand. Maybe they're divine fiat. They're just tzivui Hashem. But sometimes we say that it seems Zeres HaKasim. right? But other times, what we, you know, that's one perspective, you know, and they're there to test us. That sense of Litzar for Sabrios. In the other extreme, you could say, well, Chukim are really hard to understand. They require, like, you know, a greater investment of our rationality, even our, you know, regular rationality. You know, maybe we would quit. We wouldn't come to it on our own. It's a deeper rationality. We wouldn't come to it on our own, and or probably not. Maybe, let's assume we wouldn't. But if we work very, very hard and we don't, you know, give up faith because we know that there's more because we have a Masorah, then we'll come about, you know, to understanding and seeing why this is very logical and compelling. That's a second perspective. And in between those two perspectives, namely saying it's very logical once you, you know, are motivated, you know, to develop an appreciation for it, or that it's not logical, but it's not illogical, it's just illogical, we'll say, but it's, you know, it's divine will, either as a test or some other thing that we don't know about. Maybe it has, you know, theosophic, you know, maybe it has mystical significance. Who knows, right? In between those two perspectives is the perspective what I'm trying to suggest, which is a kind of inner logic, which means that this is not just Xeris HaKasav, it's understandable within itself and relative to, a certain system and broader perspective. You know, that doesn't mean you could come up with it if you didn't have the material, the Masorah, that provides you with the data, and if you were reconstructing it. But it's a different kind of logic. Right. And that, in a way, is a greater leap of faith, that's what I was trying to say last week, than just saying, you know, although, again, we're measuring leaps of faith. Leaps of faith are impressive, no matter what. But the leap of faith of embracing absurdity and the leap of faith embracing something which is just not logical, as opposed to the leap of faith which says, you know, surrender your regular, you know, canons of logic and develop one, like a whole understanding, you know, based on your commitment to a certain system and your immersion in it. In my opinion, you know, while the first two are more obviously impressive, you know, the last one is the one that is the most ambitious. And that's what I was suggesting last week, is my parshanut on Nas of Nishma. And it's not just Nishma, it's Nas of Nishma. The Nishma flows from the Nasa, meaning it's an inner logic. It's not a... we're not just doing it for the other two reasons, you know, and we're not saying we're not going to do it until we understand it. We're going to understand it based on our commitment to its truth and also to doing it, but especially our descent. That's what I mean by reconstructing. And in my opinion, that's what's unique. I think that this examples of this are just, evidently part of what halacha is all about. But, you know, seeing this in a bigger way, like as a critical centerpiece of, you know, halachic thinking and halachic commitment, in my opinion, is the, based on, you know, reading, you know, what the Rav wrote about it and others, is a hallmark of, I guess, the philosophy of Brisk that also expresses itself in the methodology of Brisk. That's why there's so much emphasis on, you know, formulation and reconstruction and, you know, description. But then from there, like applying it, and across, you know, the system, you know, the closed system that has developed. Right. That's what I mean. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's what I mean. Okay. So what I was saying was the critique of Tamei HaMitzvos of, you know, this is too external or this is too separate from halacha. Again, Kabbalah has this, you know, benefit, you know, beyond philosophy, for having a Masorah, for being internal and Jewish and so on. On the other hand, you know, and again, I'm not, you know, I don't think that it's a zero-sum game, that, you know, these things have to either be correct or not correct. I mean, I'm not comfortable saying, you know, that the Rambam's perspective on Tamei HaMitzvos was not correct. I am comfortable, since the Rav said it already, and I probably would have been comfortable saying it even without it, that the Tamei HaMitzvos of Yad HaChazaka are far more appealing and ambitious than the ones in Mor Nebuchim. I mean, I think we can all agree to that. But if someone says, philosophic Tamei Mitzvot versus Kabbalistic ones, you know, I don't think I have to choose, you know, since there are Chachmei Masorah who stand firmly behind each. And I think, you know, Shivim Panim LaTorah, the idea that, you know, there doesn't have to be a stira to the different dimensions of Torah, is something that I'm very comfortable with. But having said that, it is fascinating to see, you know, what these critiques are. And so part of the critique, let's say, of the Kabbalistic Tamei Mitzvot is that, yes, it's internal and it's Jewish, but is it connected enough, let's say, you know, to a more exoteric, you know, Shmiras HaMitzvos, you know, and understanding? You might say, well, who says it has to be? In other words, to a certain extent, Kabbalistic Tamei Mitzvos, unless they themselves, you know, are explained in a way that is a little more accessibly linked, you know, to the details of halakha, also create a certain dichotomy between the halakha, the learning, the lamdas, the shmiras hamitzvos. It's still, you know, you might say, oh, this is our received tradition of what these things mean on a mystical plane. That could be very fine and good. But I wouldn't say it's problematic, but I don't think philosophical and necessarily problematic either. But what I am saying is that there's a certain added charm to saying that the values and that the philosophy of halakha is connected even to the accessible halakha and its reconstruction, which is, you know, what we're talking about, halakhic values and the idea. That's what I was trying to suggest as an interpretation of Na'aseh v'Nishma, that you get your understanding after having been committed, being an insider, and developing, you know, these ideas and their interrelationship. That, in some respect, without skipping steps, is what we try to do in the concept of Talmud Torah. That we don't announce every day that this is, you know, the hashkafa that we learn from it, although sometimes we, I think, accentuate that. We try to go about it by, you know, paying close attention to the way, to the shaklavatarya of the psukim and the gemara and the, you know, and the rishonim and the achronim and the poskim and the way that it always has been done, you know, in the general way. But to stop, as we're doing it as insiders, you know, who accept all this and think that it is critically important, you know, to try to put our finger on the trends or the implications, whether it's in Hilchos Eidos or Hilchos Ishus or Avodas, you know, HaKarbanos, whatever it is, to the extent that we're able to do it. Hafok ba fok ba dekula ba, right? There's always much more. The more you know, the more, you know, you can appreciate is there, and also the more you can appreciate, you know, the connections between, you know, the various things. So that, to me, is that's a kind of Na'aseh v'Nishma, which is very, very ambitious. But, you know, for that reason, it's just interesting, you know, Rav Hirsch, you know, when he wrote his Chorei, and in his Perush al HaTorah, is sometimes very critical of other, you know, Perushim or Tamei Mitzvos. And the Rav, I think, was critical of Rav Hirsch's Tamei Mitzvos. And people, you know, have written, and they've been critical of the Rav's Tamei Mitzvos. The truth is, these are all great works with so many important insights and truths. So I'm more, I wouldn't say an apologist, Chalila, but I don't need my apologist's work, but more of a fan of all of them. I think that there are different dimensions. But I, you know, some people say, oh, this is too neo-Kantian, and, you know, that is too, you know, existentialist, you know, in its orientation. And maybe, you know, here and there, there's some, you know, truth to that. I also think that, you know, these great people, Chachmei HaMasorah, you know, who are totally immersed in the system, I think we're often attracted, you know, to certain trends, you know, because it spoke to them as people who are first and foremost, you know, immersed, you know, in Torah. So I think that, you know, Rav Hirsch certainly was very influenced by the things that he was exposed to, the currents of his time. There's no question about that. And some of the things, you know, you could question. But mostly, you know, I don't want to put percentages on it, but rove of the time, I would say, forget about how he formulates it. You know, he was attracted maybe to certain ideas, and he filtered out, you know, the ones that worked or didn't work, because he was a person who just was, you know, completely immersed in, you know, his commitment to, you know, to halacha and to the values of halacha. And the same is true for the Rav, and the same is true, you know, for all of these, for many of these, let's say, great thinkers. So it doesn't mean that here and there we can't think that something specific, you know, is less compelling or is even problematic. And it's fine as detached observers to try to, you know, weigh one against the other and to, you know, to assess that. But in terms of their larger contributions, you know, if you can identify neo-Kantian strains in the Rav's, you know, formulations and in his writings and things that appeal to him, in my opinion, it's not just because, you know, that's what he was exposed to and it appealed to him philosophically. I think more likely, you know, he was attracted, you know, to those formulations and that certain kind of idealism because it, you know, fit in with and spoke to him, you know, as somebody who spent, you know, 1,000 more, you know, times more time and effort and, you know, in terms of the importance, you know, his immersion in Torah and in mitzvahs. And the same is true for others like that as well. Which, again, doesn't mean that there aren't certain individual things more, but, or, okay. So the point I'm trying to make is that when it comes to specific critiques of Tamei HaMitzvos, the phenomenon, getting back to the phenomenon, I'm speaking about the phenomenon, I'm also just making comments as we go forward, that in addition to the enterprise of Tamei HaMitzvos, which is part of this subject, even more part of it is the question of, you know, external, supplemental, complementing, you know, material and the impact that it has. I'm just trying to show that, you know, some of these criticisms come from, I think, a very legitimate place because they are motivated by kind of purist ideology, which I totally identify with. Having said that, my own perspective on it is that it's a lot more complicated than that and that, you know, the people as filters, or the filters that these people had are, you know, just instinctive and conscious, you know, really, I think, solve a lot of the issues and the problems so that mostly whatever, you know, articulation they give to it, you shouldn't be blinded by that. And they're really expressing things which are, you know, a folkba, de kulaba, although this is a good example of Torah Mada, you know, immeasurably maybe enhanced by their, you know, ability to, you know, to use that kind of terminology or to, you know, put things in a certain kind of framework, you know, and so on. There's a difference between, you know, using external tools and language and frameworks, you know, as a mechanism, conscious or unconscious, and it really kind of, you know, diluting or corrupting, you know, the purity of the tochen, and so on. And these are very, very important distinctions, also as we get to the Tnuat HaMusar, which we'll get to in just a couple of minutes. So, again, I think, you know, that, you know, a lot of these phrases become test cases in how we understand a lot of these things. And the same is true with regard to movements, whether it's the movement of philosophy in Kabbalah or the movement of Chassidut, which I alluded to last week, which the Gra was initially, you know, so dismissive of, so passionately, you know, opposed to, because he viewed it as having much too strong antinomian elements. Per se, for the sake of Shmiras Halacha, he rejected it. He also saw it as dangerous. I think that philosophically, if it wasn't going to be, you know, stemming from and radiating out from the halacha, instead it was going to, you know, be even challenging, you know, the performance of the norm, he found that to be completely offensive and therefore illegitimate. you know, what ended up happening, you know, people, historians are of different minds, you know, whether, you know, the Gruz attack, you know, is too, you know, strong or not. You know, it's not for us to, I think, judge that. We can have opinions on it. It doesn't really matter. But I think that, you know, fair people at least would agree that whether it was overstated or not, it definitely came from these considerations. And it definitely had the effect, because it came from the Quran and the people who, you know, whose respect for, you know, his authority was just, you know, beyond you know, any kind of question, had the effect of moderating the movement of Hasidut. The reason Hasidut is, you know, with us today, you know, as part of the Olam HaTorah, whether you're a fan or not a fan, that's a, you know, it still becomes a question, whether you're a chassid or not a chassid, is because of the moderation that took place. I mean, it was both on the level of Shmiras HaMitzvos, meaning the tamping down of, you know, and you know, eliminating the bigger abuses. I mean, there are still things here and there that one can be critical about, and, you know, on a normative level, in some or many strands of Chassidut. But on the whole, in a domet to what the Gra criticized, or at least what he was worried about. But even more important is that they, this is not my chiddush, I mean, it's well known, that the moderation in doctrine, the moderation, you know, in, I'm saying the moderation in conduct, you know, the moderation also in doctrine, and especially the methodology of trying to show, you know, that, you know, if these ideas are legitimate, it's because they're connected with the categories of Torah and of Halacha. So the Magen Mezrich, you know, and others, who, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef Polnoy, I think I mentioned last week, those are the two big ones, of course, in that next generation, you know, who, you know, provided a you know, traditional basis in terms of Bekoros and connecting it to categories of Halacha and Parshanut, you know, that that brought this back into the mainstream. So it became, again, you know, hafochba, fochba, dekulaba. So the Musar movement is another example of this, although, you know, the lines are not as clearly drawn, because the Musar movement was not mostly associated with the antinomian behavior, although here and there, you know, some of the critics of the Musar movement were critical of some more extreme elements of it, the Navardic school in particular, but again, not antinomian, but for, you know, being certain extremes in ascetic behavior, you know, which rendered, let's say, the categories of halacha, you know, kind of beside the point or bidyeveds. But mostly, the problem of antinomian, you know, conduct, mishpadach ad yalachem issues, you know, was not so much an issue. Moreover, the, you know, the heads, you know, some of the foremost figures of the Musar movement were people who, you know, were very much identified as Talmidei Chachamim, and, you know, whose own credentials, you know, in terms of psak and in terms of, you know, alumnus, you know, were beyond, you know, any kind of criticism. They were present. There you go, Rabbi Yitzchak Blazer, you know, being a prime example of that, the Talmud of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter himself, you know, who's credited as being the father of the movement, being somebody whose credentials, you know, were impressive in that area. And thirdly, you know, in a much more, whatever the relationship between, let's say, Torah only, or what I'm calling Hafochba, you know, Dekulaba, and Yira, which we'll talk about in just a minute, what time's running out, really was, it's a lot closer and more subtle, you know, than some of the other issues. That's the question of how internal, how external, how much of a supplement, complement, is much more difficult to pin down. Again, there are different strains in the Muslim movement itself, and they also underwent a lot of moderation, you know, like Hasidut in another respect. But just to begin with, both, you know, the lines were much more blurred. And certainly the centrality of Talmud Torah, Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, was never threatened or questioned as much. I wouldn't say it wasn't questioned at all, in the same way that it was, you know, for example, in Chassidut, where you talk about the relationship between Tefillah and Talmud Torah. In, let's say, the Musar movement, you know, the contest, if there was one, was more, let's say, you know, Yiras Hashem, you know, and Limud HaTorah and Talmud Torah. That's just a much more, frankly, you know, it's just a much more subtle kind of a topic and discussion. So the Musar movement is a, you know, topic in its own right, and it's just a fascinating chapter because the reality of the issue being more subtle and more internal, you know, makes the hypersensitivity, let's say, you know, of those who strongly opposed it, or those who opposed it in a nuanced way, you know, however you want to look at it, in a way more more impressive, right? In other words, you don't have the same, you know, obvious, you know, dangers here. And also ideologically, as I say, the issue is much more nuanced. So, like, why, you know, why all that passion and why all that, you know, upset? Okay. So, I mean, you know, do we, as a people, we, you know, we're serious about our learning and we're serious about our ideology. So it triggers a lot of passion. Mostly that's a good thing until it gets a little bit out of control. Then it, you know, can create a lot of sinas chinam, which is a problem. Overreactions. But so that's why it's a very fascinating chapter. So the let me just talk about the hallmark of the Muslim movement just for a couple of minutes. I think I'm almost running out of time. But let me just say, so the, you know, the response of, let's say, Brisk, you know, to the Muslim movement is almost predictable. Because, you know, as I said before, in answer to your question, to Aaron's question, and I've said in the past, you know, the idea of inner logic and the idea of self-sufficiency, Torah Hashem, Tamima, you know, this idea is, you know, is a very, very much an accepted view broadly in Halacha, right? Ein Davar Rishon L'Chadash Davar Me'ata, you know, in Somchen Al Baskol, and all these kind of things. You know, we, you know, Chacham Adif Minavi, and, you know, all of this, you know, the internal, you know, the force of Torah, its independence, Torah Hashem Tamima. But for Brisk in particular, I say, it goes kind of a step further into this idea of an inner logic and a independent vocabulary, and as such, you know, the idea that you need supplements or complements, you know, is particularly anathema. Yeah, Ellie?
I'm not exactly an expert on the value of this movement, but Chedomo Rez would say, like, the philosophers, they were just reading Aristotle's books,
right,
and then just telling you the fourth law from Aristotle.
What about the Vortlach? I don't think the Rambam was saying over Vortlach. I mean, the Rambam, I think that's,
yeah,
that this, you know.
But the Misr movement, unless I'm wrong, they weren't like getting it from like secular books. They were just like extracting the ideas from the Torah, just new ideas.
Right. So the question, so I'll explain what I think the, I mean, there was some accusation of externality all there too, especially, you know, but not so much ideas, although, again, there are some, you know, Kantian connections, probably. But the idea of, I guess, the role of psychology as something that is separate from Torah, you know, and hitpalut, you know, this kind of, you know, almost like charismatic, you know, mechanisms of focusing, you know, things like that, you know, were perceived as coming from the outside. I agree. I mean, what you're saying, I think, is mostly true, just not completely true. And the mostly part of it being true is kind of what I was trying to get at a couple minutes ago when I was saying that, you know, again, just like Kabbalah was different than philosophy, I think Tnuat HaMusar was very different even than, you know, the Chassidut. And mostly because the overlap is clearer and the innovation, you know, is harder to identify. And whatever it is, most of it is not coming from the outside, and it's not coming from works from the outside, certainly. But just remember, you know, in Kabbalah, you know, Kabbalah and Halacha, that also wasn't coming from, you know, secular sources. It was coming from Masorah sources, without going into the history of, you know, of Kabbalah. But I think even more so, as I say, because the people who were ahead of it and the kind of sources were almost all internal sources. So I think that's true. And yet, there was a certain, and it depends which strands, but the, you know, the Rabbi Yisrael Salanter in particular was of the opinion, maybe we'll just talk about this because we have only like 1 minute left, and then maybe I'll explain what I mean about Brisk being particularly adamantly opposed. Brisk was adamantly opposed for the reason that I explained just a second ago, because they were, you know, of maybe all movements, the most, again, hypersensitive, you know, to anything that upsets or challenges, you know, both, you know, the self-sufficiency of, as well as I say, the inner, you know, logic, you know, of, or inner independence of, you know, halakha as a system. And that definitely comes across. But even if you don't go that far, I'd say there are some assumptions, and not just, you know, implicit ones, but ones which were also articulated by some of the Baalei Musar, which, you know, also were lightning rod of criticism of, you know, general, I guess, you know, Lithuanian-oriented Talmidei Chacham. So, for example, just to, again, the, talk about Rabbi Yisrael Salanter for a minute, and then we'll talk about some of the reactions next time. But, by the way, the Beck's book on you know, is this fellow, Emmanuel Atkus, who's a good historian. He wrote a book on Rabbi Yisrael. He also wrote a book on the Gra in recent years, but his book on Rabbi Yisrael Salanter is, I think, a very good book. He's a good researcher. It's clear if you read the material of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, and again, you know, Yitzhak Blazer, or Blazer, that the focus really here is on the relationship between Torah and Talmud Torah and Yiras Hashem. And again, that's a much more subtle, you know, issue. It's much more subtle because the Torah itself speaks independently about people's Yiras Shamayim. This is my, I'm speaking now, right? You know, and again, in the ultimate, you know, expression of Amunah, of Avram Avinu, the Av Hamon Goyim, right, who is the paradigm of us all. So it's Ati Adati Ki Rei Elokim Ata V'lo Chasachta Espidcha Es Yechidcha. And in the context of, you know, Kriyas Yamzuf, it's, you know, Vayamina Bashem, it's Vayar Yisrael Asayad Agdol Asher Asa Hashem B'Mitzrayim Vayiru Ha'amas Hashem Vayaminu Bashem V'Mitzrayim Abdom. And, you know, when Avraham Avinu wanted to say, listen, all bets are off, he said, Rakein Yiras Elokim B'Makom Azeh. So obviously Yiras Elokim, you know, has a status in Torah that is extremely lofty. You know, if you look at the relationship between Torah and Yira, you know, just superficially at least, in Mamari Chazal, then, you know, there are two interpretations you could give. You know, it's hard to know. Clearly there's a kesher between them, but is it that, you know, Yiras Elokim is a Tnai Kadum for Limudat Torah and for growth in Torah, or is it the opposite? You know, and, you know, Ein Bur, you know, Yirei Chet, Lo HaMa'aretz, you know, Chosid, you know, Reishis Chachma, Yiras Hashem. You know, you look at all those phrases, you know, some in Tanakh and some in Chazal, you know, some of them seem to say that Yiras Elokim is a prerequisite for growth and achievement in Torah, and some of them seem to say that, you know, Torah is the methodology. If you don't have Torah, if you're an Amaretz, you know, you can't be a Yorei Elokim. So which is it? I mean, obviously it's both. But which one is prior? Is Torah method for Yiras Hashem? You know, or Avas Hashem? Some people have it. Or is it the opposite, right? Is it, you know, growth in Torah and Yiras Elokim is an expression of that? And how do you pursue, how do you basically cultivate Yiras Hashem, right? Is it through Talmud Torah, like, you know, you have, you know, when the Eitz Hara acts up, Moshkei Ol Beis HaMedrash, and other Mamarim again of Chazal, which seem to say that Limud HaTorah, you know, is the best way, you know, to combat, you know, any kind of vacillation, anything that challenges your Yiras Hashem? Or is there some sort of separate, you know, program, you know, that is required? So what is the relationship between the two? Is there any questioning of the, let's say, primacy of Talmud Torah, you know, next to Yiras Hashem, or not? And, as I say, what is the methodology that one brings to the other? So what Etkus points out is that there's a certain, you know, kind of progression. That if you look in the Kisvei Agra and then Reb Chaim Volozhiner, so that, you know, most of that's a response to Hasidus, and again to the implied attack on the primacy of Talmud Torah, and you get a certain, you know, heavy emphasis of the Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam aspect of it, and Reb Chaim Volozhiner even more so, even relative to Yira. The best way to pursue Yira is in tents of Talmud Torah, you know, in Nefesh HaChaim, you know, and so on. And then the Musar movement is kind of either a corrective to that, or becomes, you know, the next, you know, challenge, you know, for that perspective. So, what, you know, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's ideological view was that the intellect and let's say man's you know, a sinful nature or his passions or his yetzer hara are constantly, you know, at war. Okay, that's not so mechudash. I mean, that's a very prevalent view. It's not the only view. It's a conventional view. But what isn't so completely conventional is that he came to the conclusion that the seichel alone, that the intellect alone, cannot neutralize or override, you know, man's more negative inclinations. And since seichel, you know, his weapon is limud haTorah, so what he was saying, first by implication, but then programmatically, explicitly, was that, you know, even for Talmidei Chachamim, you know, Limud HaTorah alone was insufficient. Even that Limud HaTorah exclusively, right, could not, you know, produce, you know, the result of Yiras Shamayim. And therefore, you need a program, right, which includes, like, focusing on, you know, with certain mechanisms on, you know, psychological insights, you know, questioning oneself, you know, an emphasis on the midos, you know, the problematic midos that a person finds in himself in a halachic way, but again, as part of this more particular program, as well as, because again, the Bali Musar, the giants of the Musar movement were all, you know, formidable Talmidei Chachamim, and not just in their accomplishment, but in their ideology. So you need, you know, a program of Limud HaTorah, but you also need this program of developing, you know, an insight into yourself and so on and so forth. And the greatest Talmidei Chachamim are, you know, corrupted, or this is a kind of a negius, this is his view, you know, absent developing this other support mechanism, so that it doesn't matter how big a Talmud Chacham you are and how sincere you are, right? You just need supplementary or complementary educational exposures. And that was something, you know, even in its more moderate form, which Rabbi Yisrael Salanter mostly adopted, other Talmidei Chachamim found to be offensive and found to be challenging of what I'm calling this hafochba de kula ba Talmud Torah Keneged Kula mentality. So I guess I have to stop. We'll pick up just on some of what the assumptions are and then some of the actual expressions. First, very quickly in the early part, but I want to focus on a little bit on Brisk, and I said I would do the Chazon Ish, especially when I would be Tachon. So, we'll talk about them going forward.